Well, that was going to present a problem. I wanted to get this thing flying. And once I did, that would mean flying it to help in the fight against the Krell. And if we couldn't fix it, well, I'd need to turn it over. Regardless of what I thought of Ironsides, I couldn't just sit on this ship forever. Not if it could mean the difference between the survival and extinction of humanity. I had opened my mouth to argue with M'Bot further when a set of lights started flashing on the dashboard.
Multiple atmospheric incursions have been detected by my short-range sensors, M'Bot said. Debris has begun falling toward the planet, with 43 ships following.
43? I said, glancing at his sensor readout. Short range for him was apparently still pretty long, by our standards. Wow, you can spot them, even in a debris fall?
Easily.
Proof already that the DDF could use this technology. Our scanners weren't as accurate as that. That knowledge immediately made me uncomfortable. Still, 43 Krell? The maximum they ever fielded was 100 ships, so this was an impressive force. I hit the button to open the canopy, then hauled myself out and hopped off onto a rock. Krell, I said to Rig, a big flight.
Are we in danger here?
No, they're coming from the other direction. But the cadets have been training long enough now that Ironsides has started sending them up for real as support units during combat. Firestorm flight went 2 days ago.
So,
I'd better get going. Just in case. Chapter 19. I started running. A sense of anxiety built in me as I heard the distant sound of debris hitting. I somehow knew that Ironsides would send my flight up for this attack. She liked testing cadets in real combat experience. And we were far enough in our training that Cobb had warned we'd soon be sent into some real battles. It was our turn. The time had come. So I forced myself into a jog, then a dash, across the dusty ground. Sweat pouring down the sides of my face, I felt a horrible inevitability as I approached the base, where warning klaxons blared. Not fear, really, but dread. What if I was too late? What if the others went into battle without me? I entered the base, then rounded the outside wall toward our launch pad. A single ship sat there, alone. I had been right. I reached my ship in a sweaty mess, pushing my own ladder into place as several members of the ground crew noticed me and started yelling. One got there in time to stabilize my ladder.
"Where have you been, cadet?" she shouted at me. "The rest of your flight went up 20 minutes ago."
I shook my head, sliding into the cockpit, too exhausted to speak.
"No pressure suit?" the ground crewer said. "No time." "All right. Don't make any sharp ascents then. You have clearance to go. Call in your flight leader, then move."
I nodded, then pulled on my helmet. This one, like the one in the training room, had the strange lumps inside, to measure whatever it was they wanted to measure about me. I flipped on the flight radio band as the canopy lowered.
"Don't let your nerves get the best of you,"
Jerkface was saying over the radio.
"Stay focused. Watch your wingmate. You heard Cobb. We don't have to fire. Just focus on keeping yourselves from being turned to slag."
"What?" I said. "What's going on?"
"Spin?" Jerkface asked. "Where have you been?"
"In my cave. Where else would I be?"
I engaged my acclivity ring and launched my ship upward. G-forces hit me, and my stomach felt like it was trying to escape through my toes. I slowed the ascent.
"Repeat that part to me. You're going into battle? You're not staying at the edge of combat?"
"The Admiral finally wants to let us fight,"
Bim said, eager.
"Contain yourself, Bim," Jerkface said. "Spin. We're at 11.3-302.7-21,000. Get here as fast as you can. Ironsides has ordered us into a small firefight alongside a flight of full pilots. We're there to confuse the enemy and hopefully split their attention."
In other words, we're being sent in as targets, I thought, wiping my hand on my jumpsuit, my heartbeat thrumming, sweat making my hair stick to my face. Or they are, without me. Not for long. I slammed the throttle forward, going into overburn. The grav caps protected me for 3 seconds, and then I slammed back in my seat. I could take G-forces like these, though, pushing me straight backward. It wasn't pleasant, but I didn't risk blacking out. I just had to get to speed, then carefully climb, using the acclivity ring. I quickly reached Mag 10, which was the upper speed threshold for a POCO, at least safely. Even this was stretching the limits. The atmospheric scoops, which pushed air away around the ship in a bubble, preventing me from ripping off my own wings during tight maneuvers, were overwhelmed, and my ship rattled from the motion. The friction of air resistance made my normally invisible shield start to glow. I climbed upward as well, but carefully, slower, as the G-forces in that direction threatened to knock me out. Going up forced my blood down into my feet. I did the stomach-clenching exercises we'd been taught in centrifuge training. But still, darkness started to creep around the outsides of my vision. I held on, pressed down at 6 times my normal weight. Though the flight would only take a short while, I had to listen to my friends in battle all the way.
"Careful, Hurl. Not too eager." "One's on me. I've got one on me." "Dodge, FM." "Dodging. Dodging. Scud, who was that?" "Nightstorm 6. That's my brother, guys. Call sign Vent. FM, you owe me some fries or something."
"To your right, Arturo, look up."
"Looking. Stars, what a mess."
Finally, my dash beeped, indicating I was approaching my desired coordinates. I let off on the altitude lever, then performed a rapid deceleration. In a POCO with atmospheric scoops, that meant spinning my ship in the air, the grav caps kicking in, then firing my booster backward to slow me down. I came out of it after slowing to Mag 1, standard dogfighting speed. I spun my POCO around, facing toward the battlefield, where distant lights flashed in the dark morning sky. Debris fell as red streaks.
"I'm here," I said to the others.
"Get in and help Morningtide,"
Jorgen shouted at me.
"Can you spot her?"
"Looking,"
I said, frantic, scanning my proximity sensor screen.
"There."
I hit overburn, accelerating her direction.
"Guys," I said, glancing at the scanner. "Morningtide has picked up a tail."
"I see it," Jerkface said. "Morningtide, you read?"
"Trying? Trying, Dodge?"
My ship screamed toward the battlefield. I could now see the individual fighters, a swirling mess mixed with destructor bolts and the occasional light lance. Morningtide's POCO pulled upward into a loop, trailed by 3 Krell ships. Almost there.
Almost there.
The Krell destructors flared. Hit. Hit again. And then, a burst of light. A spray of sparks. And Morningtide died in a massive explosion. She didn't have a chance to eject. Kimmelin screamed, a high-pitched, panicked, pained sound.
"No," Jerkface said. "No, no, no!"
I arrived, flying at Mag 3, too fast for normal dogfighting maneuvers, but still managed to spear one of the Krell ships with my light lance. But it was too late. The fiery sparks that had been Morningtide went out as they fell. I spun and reversed my thrust, letting go of the light lance and flinging the Krell ship to the side. Another of our fighters came in after it, shooting and managing to blast it down. I fell in beside Jerkface, silently smothering my own screams. He'd lost his wingmate. Where was Arturo? I couldn't make out anything tactical in the fray. My flight zipped in all directions, drawing fire, yes, but also adding to the confusion. A few larger classes of DDF fighters wound through it all, mixing with some dozen Krell ships, each trailing wires in that same unfinished way. I was crying, but I set my jaw and kept on Jorgen's wing. He expertly speared a Krell ship with his light lance, and it tried to break away, so I speared it as well.
"That debris, Jorgen," I said. "Coming down at your 2, falling slowly."
"Right."
We both hit our throttles, as Cobb had taught us, and pulled the enemy ship toward the debris. At the last minute, we cut our lines and split to the sides, slamming the Krell ship into the debris in a fiery explosion.
What are you two doing? Cobb said over the line. You were ordered into defensive postures.
Cobb, I said.
Morningtide, keep your head, girl.
He shouted.
Grieve when the debris rests. Right now, obey orders. Defensive postures.
I gritted my teeth, but didn't argue, following Jorgen as he wound through the smoke trails left by falling chunks of debris. That looked to be Arturo and Ned to my right, leapfrogging each other with quick accelerations and decelerations to keep the enemy from focusing on either one of them. That kind of technique could confuse the Krell, much like overwhelming them with targets. Morningtide.
Quirk, Jorgen said. What are you doing?
I realized I could still hear Kimmelin's soft whine of pain over the radio. I searched the scanner, then spotted a single Poco, without a wingmate, hovering near the perimeter of the fight.
Quirk, move, Jorgen said. You're a clear target. Get in here.
Kimmelin said. I was trying to line up a shot. I was going to save her.
Join the fight, Jorgen shouted. Cadet, hit your throttle and get in here.
I'll cover her, I said, moving to break off as we zoomed past two Krell coming the other way. So many sparks and destructor shots lit the sky, I almost felt I was down in Igneous, swallowed up by a forge.
No, Jorgen said to me. You see Bim? At your eight? Cover him. I'll deal with Kimmelin.
Understood. I zipped down and to my left, the grav caps covering the G-forces of the sharp turn. As I moved, however, a spot on my dash lit up, a bright violet warning light near my proximity sensors. I'd picked up a tail. Though we'd barely touched on dogfighting, Cobb's training snapped into my mind. Trust the scanner. Don't waste time trying to get a visual. Keep your focus on flying.
Spin, FM said. You've got a tail!
I was already pulling my ship into an evasive loop, counting on the grav caps to handle the G-force. Something clicked immediately in my mind. The training, the way my face grew cold, the way my mind snapped into focus despite the fatigue, the stress, and the grief. It was almost like it didn't matter if a Krell was following me. In that moment, it was just me and the ship, extensions of one another. I pulled out of my loop into a straight dive, then cut to the side and launched a perfect light lance hook into a slowly falling chunk of debris. I didn't go quite fast enough, and when my grav caps cut, the G-forces rammed me down in my seat. I saw black at the corners of my vision, but held on. I spun around sharply and buzzed another chunk of debris, trailing its smoke in my wake, then zoomed right between two Krell ships coming the other direction. My tail lost me in the turn, and I caught a flashing explosion behind me as one of the full pilots picked it off while it was trying to catch up to me.
Good maneuver, Spin, Cobb said softly in my ear. Excellent maneuver, actually. But don't get too flashy. Remember the simulation. Flashy moves can still get you killed.
I nodded, though he couldn't see.
Bim is at your 10 now, up about 150. Get on him. That boy is too eager.
As if on cue, Bim's voice entered the flight line. Guys, do you see that? Up in front of me? There was a larger firefight happening in the distance. We'd been ordered to join the smaller of the two skirmishes. I could make out the falling sparks and missed destructor shots of that larger battle, but I didn't think that was what Bim was indicating. As I fell in at his side, I spotted it. A Krell ship, but a different model from the curved fighters. This one was bulbous, like a bulging fruit with wings at the top. Or, no. That was a ship flying with something huge attached to the bottom. A bomber, I realized, remembering my studies. One carrying a lifebuster.
Lifebuster, Jorgen said. Cobb, we've confirmed sighting of a lifebuster bomb. The other flight radio bands are talking about it too, Cobb said. Steady, cadet. The Admiral is already dealing with that bomber.
I can hit it, Cobb, Bim said. I can bring it down. I expected Cobb to dismiss that idea immediately, but he didn't.
Let me call for orders and tell them you have a visual.
Bim took that as confirmation. You with me, Spin?
Every step, I said. Let's go.
Wait, Cadet,
Cobb said.
There's something odd about these descriptions. Can you confirm? That bomb sounds larger than usual.
Bim wasn't listening. I watched out my cockpit window as he dove toward the solitary bomber, which had, following usual Krell protocol, slipped down to low altitude to try flying in underneath the AA guns.
Something's wrong, Cobb said.
A group of shadows broke off the sides of the bomb, smaller Krell ships, almost invisible in the darkness. Four of them. They lit up the air with red destructor blasts. One grazed my canopy, causing my shield to crackle with light. My nerves jolted and I spun my ship, by instinct, to the side.
Cobb, I said. Four escort ships just broke off the bomber.
The ships buzzed us. I dodged, barely, my hands sweaty on my controls.
They're faster than regular Krell.
This is something new, Cobb said. Fall back, you two.
I can hit it, Cobb, Bim said.
The light of his destructor glowed at the front of his ship as he powered up a long-range shot. The four Guardian ships swarmed toward us, firing again.
Bim! I screamed.
I was pretty sure I saw him look toward me, light reflecting on his helmet visor, as the blasts hit his ship, overwhelming his shield with concentrated fire. Bim's ship exploded into several large chunks, one of which slammed into my ship. I was flung to the side as my Poco went into a spin. Quirk screamed my name as the world rocked. The lights on my dash went insane, the shield down warning blaring. G-forces hit as the grav caps were overwhelmed. Nausea flooded me, and everything became a blur. But my training still kicked in. Somehow, pulling hard on the control sphere, I managed to hit the dive controls, which pivoted my acclivity ring on its front hinge, like a hatch swinging open. That angled it toward the nose of my ship, and the maneuver pulled me out of the fall. The world righted itself, and I hung there in a hover, my nose pointed straight at the ground. Lights flashed on my dash. Below, I watched as Bim's remains hit the surface in a ripple of soft explosions. He'd never even picked a call sign.
The enemy is disengaging, Ned said. Looks like they've had enough.
I listened, numb to other reports. A strike team of full pilots went after the bomber, and rather than risk losing the weapon, the Krell pulled into a full retreat. The bomber escaped, as did enough ships to keep the Admiral from giving chase. I just hung there, blue glow of the acclivity ring, a cold, lifeless light in front of me.
Spin,
Jorgen said.
Report in. Are you all right?
No, I whispered, but finally reset my acclivity ring, rotating my ship to the standard axis. I channeled power to the shield igniter, waited until the light powered up, then grabbed the handle and slammed it backward. Another shield crackled to life around my Poco, then turned invisible. I climbed up into line with the others.
Vocal confirmation of status, Jorgen ordered.
We responded, and everyone else was still there. But when we flew back to base, our formation had two stark holes in it. Bim and Morningtide were gone. Skyward flight had been reduced from 9 to 7. Part 3. Interlude. Admiral Judy Ironsides Ivins always made a point of reading the casualty reports. She got people killed. Every battle, she made decisions, some of them mistakes, that ended lives. Perhaps there was an astral balance chart somewhere out there, kept in the stars by the ancient saints, which weighted the defiant lives she lost against the ones she saved. If so, that scale had been greatly tipped by today's battle. Two cadets were dead after barely a month of training in the cockpit. She read their names, tried to commit them to memory, though she knew she'd fail. There had just been so many. She reverently set the list of names and short biographies on top of her desk. Two other pilots had died as well, and composing letters to their families would take a bite out of her evening, but she'd do it. To those families, the loss would take a bite out of their lives. She was halfway done, writing by hand instead of using a typewriter, when Cobb came to yell at her at last. She saw him reflected in the brass of the polished spyglass she kept on her desk, a relic from a much, much earlier time. He stopped in the doorway and didn't lay into her immediately, but let her finish her current letter. She signed it at the bottom, making a flourish with a fountain pen, a gesture that somehow seemed both necessary and ostentatious in such a letter.
"Are you happy, Judy?" he finally asked. "Now that you've gotten two of them killed, are you scudding happy?"
"I haven't been happy in years, Cobb." She turned her chair, leaning back and meeting his glare. She'd been anticipating, perhaps even relishing, his inevitable arrival. It was good she still had someone to defy her. Most everyone else who had done that was dead now. He limped into the small room, which was piled high with papers, keepsakes, books, an embarrassingly messy office. Yet it was the only place she felt comfortable.
"You can't keep doing this," Cobb said. "First you lower the age of testing. Now you send them into battle before they really know how to fly. You can't keep firing on full auto while you simultaneously steal ammunition from the stores. Eventually, you're going to run out of bullets."
"You'd rather I let Alta fall?" He looked to the side, toward an old map she still kept on the wall. The glass was dusty with age, and the paper inside had started to curl. It was a plan for Alta, from their development session almost a decade ago. They'd imagined a city with massive neighborhoods and large farms. A fantasy. Reclaiming a dead world was harder work than they'd anticipated. She pushed herself to her feet, the old captain's chair creaking.
"I will spend their lives, Cobb. I'll eagerly put everyone in the DDF in danger if it means protecting Alta. At some point, it stops being worth the losses, Judy."
"Yes, and I happen to know when that point is." She stepped up to him, holding his gaze.
"It's when the very last Defiant heaves their very last breath. Until then, we hold this base."
If they lost Alta, then Igneous could be bombed from above, destroying the apparatus and humankind's ability to build ships. If that happened, the Defiance would return to living in broken clans, like rats to be hunted. They either stood their ground, or they gave up on ever becoming a true civilization again. Finally, Cobb relented and turned to leave. From him, lack of complaint was agreement.
"I noticed," Judy said, "that your little coward didn't arrive at the battle until most of the fighting had already happened."
He spun on her, practically snarling.
"She lives in an unimproved cave, Judy. Alone. You realize that, don't you? One of your pilots lives in a makeshift camp beyond the city limits because you refused to give her a bunk."
It was satisfying to see that anger in him. She worried he would burn out one of these days. He never had been the same since the Battle of Alta.
"Do you know what the readouts are saying?" Judy asked.
"The scans of her brain?"
"Some of our doctors are certain they've figured out how to spot it now. I suppose I should thank you for that. Getting a chance to study Chaser's daughter in flight might finally give me proof. She has the defect."
That gave him pause.
"We barely understand what it means," he finally said. "And your doctors are biased. A few confusing events and some stories of the past aren't enough to judge a girl's entire life, particularly a girl so talented."
"That's the problem," Judy said. She was surprised to hear Cobb argue, honestly. Many politicians denied the defect's existence, but Cobb? He'd seen its effects personally.
"As useful as this data is, I can't risk letting her have a commission in the DDF. She would be nothing but a distraction and a blow to morale." "A distraction to you, maybe. A blow to your morale. The way you're acting is a disgrace to the DDF.
For all intents and purposes, I am the DDF.
Stars help us. There's nobody else left.
He glared at her.
I'm going to give the girl a personal radio. I won't have one of my cadets outside my reach. Unless you would reconsider giving her a bunk.
If I make it too easy on her, she might decide to stay, instead of doing the sensible thing and moving on. Cobb limped toward the door. He refused to use a cane, even after all these years, but paused again there, hand on the frame.
Do you ever wish one of the others had survived?
He asked.
Sousa, Nightingale, Strife, Admiral Heimlein.
Anyone but me? Judy asked.
Basically.
I'm not sure I'd wish this command on them, she said. Not even the ones I hated. Cobb grunted, then disappeared into the hallway. Chapter 20. The day after Morningtide and Bim died, I arrived late for Cobb's class. It was only by about 5 minutes, but it was still my first time being late. Everything just felt so wrong. I vaguely remembered tromping back to my cave the day before, ignoring Embot. Rig had already gone home, and curling up in my cockpit bed. Then I'd just lain there, not sleeping but wishing that I would, thinking but wishing that I would stop, not crying but somehow wishing that I could. Today, nobody called me on my tardiness. Cobb wasn't there yet, though almost all of the remaining cadets had assembled. Everyone but Kimmelin, which worried me. Was she okay? My boots squeaked on the floor as I walked over and sat. I didn't want to look at the conspicuously empty seats, but that made me feel like a coward, so I forced myself to stare at Morningtide's spot. Just 2 days ago, I'd been standing there, helping her understand. She'd almost never said anything. But somehow the room felt so much quieter without her.
Hey, Spin, Ned finally said. You're always talking about honor and the glory of dying like warriors and crap like that.
Yeah, so?
So,
Ned said.
Maybe we could use a little of that crap right now.
Ned slumped in place, barely fitting into his mock pit. He was the tallest one in the room, and burly, too. I'd always thought of him simply as the larger of Jerkface's two cronies. But there was more to him, a thoughtfulness.
Well?
He asked. I said, struggling to find words. That all feels stupid now. I couldn't rattle off some line about vengeance. Not today. Doing so would feel like playing a part in one of Grand Grand's stories, while the loss felt so very real. But did that make my conviction all just bravado? Was I a coward hiding behind aggressive platitudes? A real warrior would shrug it off. Did I really think these were the last friends I'd lose? FM climbed out of her seat and walked over to me. She squeezed me on the shoulder, a strikingly familiar gesture from a girl I knew only passingly well, despite our time in the same flight. What was her story? I'd never found a way to ask. I glanced toward Bim's place, thinking of the incredibly awkward, yet wonderful, way he'd tried to flirt with me. Do you know where Kimmelin is? I asked FM. She got up and ate with us, the tall girl whispered. But she stopped at the restroom on the way to class. Maybe someone should go check on her? Before I could get up, Jerkface was on his feet, clearing his throat. He looked around at the other five of us. Me and FM, Hurl, slumped in her seat. She didn't seem to be treating this like a game any longer. Arturo, who sat with hands clasped, tapping his index fingers together at a rapid pace, like some kind of nervous tick. Ned, sitting with his feet up and resting on the incalculably valuable hologram projector at the front of his mockpit. Remarkably, his bootlaces were untied.
I suppose, Jerkface said, that I should say something.
Of course, FM whispered, rolling her eyes, though she returned to her own place. Jerkface began speaking in a stiff voice.
The DDF Protocol Handbook
explains that to die in the cockpit, fighting to protect our homeland, is the bravest and greatest gift a person can give. Our friends, though taken too early, were models of defiant ideals.
He's reading, I realized, from notes written on his hand.
We will remember them as soldiers, Jerkface continued, now holding his hand up before him. If you need counseling at this loss, or for any reason, as your flight leader, I am here. Please come to me, so I can make you feel better. I will gladly bear the burden of your grief, so that you can focus on your flight training. Thank you.
He sat down. And, well, that was probably the dumbest speech I'd ever heard. More about him than about those empty seats. But I suppose he had tried.
Cobb finally limped through the door, holding a fistful of papers and muttering something to himself.
Flight positions, he snapped. We're going to cover tandem maneuvering today, again. The way you guard each other is so sloppy, I'd expect to see you on a plate of mess hall food.
We just kind of stared at him.
Move, he barked.
Everyone started strapping in. I, instead, stood up.
Is that it? I demanded. Aren't you going to say anything about them? About Bim, or Morningtide, or what the Admiral did to-
The Admiral, Cobb said, did nothing to you. The Krell killed your friends.
That's rat crap, I blurted. If you toss a kid into a lion's den, can you really blame the lion?
He met my eyes, but I wasn't going to back down this time. I wasn't sure what I wanted, but at least this emotion, feeling furious at him, at the Admiral, at the DDF, was better than emptiness. We glared at each other until the door squeaked and opened, and Kimmelin stepped in. Though her long black hair was combed, as usual, into perfect curls, her eyes were puffy and red. Cobb glanced at her and his eyes widened, as if he was surprised to see her. He thought she'd given up, I realized. Instead, puffy eyes and all, Kimmelin raised her chin. Cobb nodded toward her seat and she strode over, a model of defiant poise, and sat down. In that moment, she seemed more like a warrior than I'd ever been. I set my jaw, then took my seat and strapped in. Shoving Cobb around wasn't going to relieve my anger at the Admiral. I needed a control sphere in my hand and a destructor trigger under my finger. That was probably why Cobb wanted to work us hard today, to make us sweat, maybe make us forget for a little while. And, yeah, I was on board for that. Cobb, however, didn't turn on our projectors. Instead, he slowly took a folding chair, then limped to the center of the room and unfolded it. He sat down, clasping his hands before him. I had to lean out the side of my rig to see him, as did most of the others. He looked old, older than he deserved to.
I know how it feels, he said. Like there's been a hole carved right out of you. A chunk of flesh that's just not going to grow back. You can function, you can fly, but you're going to leave a blood trail for a while. I should say something here about loss, something wise. Old Mara, who taught me to fly, would have. She's dead now.
Cobb shook his head.
Sometimes I don't feel like a teacher. I feel like a munitions man, reloading artillery. I stuff you into the chamber, fire you into the sky, then grab another shell.
Hearing him talk that way was discomforting, unnatural. Like a parent suddenly admitting they didn't know what love felt like. We'd all heard stories about flight instructors. Old, grizzled, quick to bite your head off, but stuffed full of wisdom. In that moment, though, I saw the man, not the instructor. That man was afraid and distraught, and as pained to lose students as we were to lose friends. He wasn't some grizzled veteran with all the answers. He was a man who had, almost by coincidence, survived long enough to be made into a teacher. He had to teach us both the things he knew and the things he clearly hadn't yet figured out himself. Claim the stars, I said. Cobb looked up at me. When I was a girl, I said, I wanted to become a pilot so I would be celebrated. And my father told me to set my sights higher. He told me to claim the stars. I looked upward and tried to imagine those twinkling lights, past the roof, up through the sky, piercing the rubble belt, where the saints welcomed the souls of the fallen when they died. It hurts, I said, more than I thought it would. I knew so little about Bim, only that he liked to smile. Morningtide, she could barely understand us, but she refused to give up. For a moment, I thought I could imagine myself soaring upward among those lights, like Gran-Gran had taught me. I felt everything falling beneath me, becoming distant. All I could see were those points of light streaking around on all sides. They're up in the sky now, I said softly. Forever among the stars. I'm going to join them. I snapped out of the trance and was suddenly back in the room with the others. I'm going to strap in, and I'm going to fight. That way when I die, at least I'll die in a cockpit, reaching for heaven. The others stilled, ushering in an uncertain silence, like the moment between two meteor impacts. Ned had sat up in his seat, no longer lounging, and he gave me an enthusiastic thumbs up and a nod. Across from me, I found Jerkface staring at me, an inscrutable frown on his face. All right, Cobb said, standing up. Let's stop wasting time. Helmets on. I grabbed my helmet and pulled it on, ignoring Jerkface's stare. I immediately jumped, however, and pulled the helmet off. What? Cobb said, limping over to me. The diodes inside are warm, I said, feeling them. What does it mean?
Nothing, Cobb said. Probably.
That doesn't reassure me, Cobb. What is going on? He lowered his voice.
Some medical types, who think they're smart, believe they can tell from a bunch of readouts if you're going to run away like your father.
My father didn't
calm down. We prove them wrong about you with good flying. That's your best tool. Can you wear that?
He nodded to the helmet. Yeah. They aren't painfully hot. I was just surprised.
Put it on then. And let's get to work.
Chapter 21. Cobb kept his promise. He worked us hard that day. We practiced coordinated banking, formations, and wingmate guarding exercises. We worked until my fingers felt stiff as gears, my arms ached like I'd been lifting weights, and my brain basically turned to mush. He even worked us through lunch, forcing an aide to bring everyone else sandwiches. I ate rat jerky and mushrooms like always. The diodes in my helmet cooled down as I worked. The admiral thought she could tell from some readouts if I would be a coward. What kind of insanity was that? There was no time to worry about it, though. Cobb ran us through debris dodging, light lance turns, and shield reignition drills. It was exhausting in a good way, and the only time I thought of Bim was when I realized that nobody was complaining that, yet again, we weren't being allowed to use our weapons. When Cobb at long last let us go, I felt as if I could have curled up right there and dozed off.
Hey, Arturo, Ned said as he stood and stretched. These projectors are pretty good. You think they could simulate a world where you're not a scudding terrible pilot?
All we need for that, Arturo said, is an off button for your radio. I'm certain we'd all improve by huge leaps if we didn't have to listen to your incessant jabbering. Besides, as I recall, you were the one who ran into me earlier.
You were in my way.
Boys, boys! Hurl said, sauntering past. Can't we make peace? Find common ground, and agree that you're both terrible pilots.
Ha! Arturo said. You just watch. I'll make you eat those words someday, Hurl.
I'm hungry enough that I'd eat them now, she said, if they had a decent sauce on them.
The mess hall better not be closed. Quirk, can I have your dessert?
What? The girl said, looking up from her harness, which she'd been clipping together and folding neatly in her seat, like she always did when getting out of her mock pit.
You're nice and stuff,
Hurl said. I figure you'll give in if I push hard enough. So, can I eat your dessert?
Bless your stars, Kimmelin said. But touch my pie, and I'll rip your fingers off.
She blushed when she said it, and lifted her hand in front of her mouth. She'll do it, Hurl, I joked. It's always the nice ones you have to worry about.
Yeah, Hurl said. Ain't that the...
She trailed off as she realized I was the one who'd spoken. Then she turned and continued out the door. I knew that look in her eyes. Ever since Jorgen outed me as Chaser's daughter, things hadn't been the same between Hurl and me. The others piled out of the chamber. I sighed, gathering my pack, preparing for an exhausted hike back to my cavern. As I hefted it over my shoulder, I realized that FM hadn't left. She was standing by the wall watching me. She was so tall and beautiful. As cadets, we kept DDF pilot dress standards. For daily work, we could choose jumpsuits or standard DDF uniforms if we wanted. We just had to be ready to change into flight suits if a call came up. Most of us simply wore the jumpsuits, which were the most comfortable. Not FM. Alongside her polished boots, she often wore a tailored uniform with a jacket that somehow looked more stylish on her than others. She was so perfect. She almost seemed more like a statue than a person.
Thank you, she said to me, for what you said earlier about Bim, Morningtide, and the stars.
You didn't find it overly aggressive? I asked. FM was always complaining that the rest of us were too aggressive, which didn't make sense to me. Wasn't aggression the point of war?
Well, most of what you say is utter nonsense, FM said. Windy bravado made as an excuse to tout jingoistic mantras instilled in you by a lifetime of defiant indoctrination. But what you said earlier, that was from the heart. I needed to hear it. Thank you.
You're a weird girl, FM, I said. I had no idea what most of what she'd said had meant. At his desk, Cobb snorted and glanced at me from behind his paperwork. You, of all people, are calling someone weird? His glance seemed to ask. I walked with FM out into an empty hallway. The other cadet flights had finished classes hours ago.
I want to make it clear, FM said as we walked together, that I don't blame you for your attitudes. You're a product of enormous societal pressure, forcing young people into increasingly aggressive postures. I'm sure on the inside you're sweet.
I'm actually not, I said, grinning. But I'm okay if people underestimate me. Perhaps the Krell will do the same, so I can savor the surprise in their eyes as I rip those very eyes from their skulls. FM looked at me aghast. If, that is, they have eyes under that armor. Or skulls. Well, whatever they have, I'll rip it out. I glanced at her, then grinned more broadly. I'm joking, FM. Kind of. I say things like that because they're fun. Like the old stories, you know?
I haven't read those old stories.
You'd probably hate them. Why do you always talk about the rest of us being too aggressive? Aren't you defiant?
I was raised defiant, she said. But I choose now to be what people down below call a disputer. I raise objections about the way the war is being run. I think we should throw off the oppressive mantle of military government.
I stopped in place, shocked. I'd never heard words like that spoken before. So, you're a coward?
FM blushed, standing up taller. I'd have thought you, of all people, would be careful about throwing around that term.
Sorry, I said, blushing in return. She was right. But still, I had trouble understanding what she was saying. I understood the words, but not the meaning. Throw off military government? Who would be in charge of the war then?
I am still willing to fight, FM said, her head high as we walked. Just because I want change doesn't mean I'll let the Krell destroy us all. But do you realize what it's doing to our society? To train our children, practically from birth, to idealize and glorify fighting? To worship the first citizens like saints?
We should be teaching our children to be more caring, more inquisitive. Not only to destroy, but to build.
I shrugged. Those kinds of things seemed easy to say when you lived in the deep caverns, where a bomb wouldn't kill your family. Still, it was nice to get some answers about the woman. She was so poised, it was hard to think of her as a girl, even though she was the same age as the rest of us. If I walked too far with her toward the mess hall, though, I might run into the MPs and get into trouble. They'd stopped escorting me out of class every day, but I didn't believe for a moment that meant I could go to dinner. So I bade FM farewell, and she jogged off to catch up with the others. I started toward the exit, digging in my pack for some water, but remembered I'd left my last full canteen by my seat in the classroom. Great. Feeling my exhaustion from the training return, I trudged back to the classroom. Cobb had activated the hologram in the center of the room, projecting a small version of a battlefield. In front of him, ships the size of ball bearings zipped and flew among debris trailing fire and smoke. Krell ships, flat and no larger than merit ships, fired tiny destructors. He's re-watching the fight from yesterday, I realized. The one where Bim and Morningtide died. I'd had no idea the battles were recorded. I picked out my ship as it zipped into the battle. I felt the overwhelming chaos again, the rush of finally being in a real fight. I could almost hear the explosions, Kimmelin's worried voice, the sound of my own breathing, excited, sharp. Anticipation, even a little fear, rose inside me while I watched. Powerless. Morningtide died again. My gut clenched, but I wouldn't let myself look away. In the room, my ship zipped through the fray, picking up a tail. I dove around a falling piece of rubble, using my light lance to pivot with exactness, then soared between two other Krell ships. Cobb paused the simulation with a gesture. He stepped forward, focusing on my ship, frozen in the air amid a spectacular show of destructors, falling streaks of light and exploding ships. Then he rewound the simulation and played it through again, watching my maneuver. I almost blacked out, I noted from the doorway. I didn't have control of my speed, and didn't cut the turn before the grav caps overloaded.
It was still quite the maneuver, he said, particularly for a cadet. Remarkable, almost unbelievable.
Jerkface is better than I am.
Jorgen is an excellent technical pilot. But he doesn't feel it like you do. You remind me of your father.
He seemed grim as he said it. I suddenly felt awkward, so I crossed to my simulator and grabbed my canteen. Cobb played out the rest of the battle, and I forced myself to watch as my ship and Bim's chased the Krell bomber. Cobb froze the simulation again as the four strange guard ships broke off the enemy bomber, the ones who would, momentarily, shoot down Bim. What are they? I asked.
Something new. They haven't altered their tactics in over a decade. What changed now?
He narrowed his eyes.
We survive by being able to anticipate the Krell. Anytime you can guess what your enemy is going to do, you have an advantage. No matter how dangerous they are, if you know their next move, you can counter it.
Huh. That struck me, and I found myself nodding. Cobb shut down the hologram and hobbled back toward his desk.
Here,
he said, sliding a box off the top and handing it to me.
I forgot to give this to you earlier.
A personal radio?
Normally, we only give these to full pilots who get off-duty time down in Igneous. But since you live off-base, I figured you should have one. Keep it on you at all times. You'll get a general warning call when the Krell attack.
I took the device, which was rectangular and boxy, maybe the size of a small one-handed training weight. My father had carried one of these. Cobb waved to dismiss me, then settled down in his seat and started looking through his papers. I lingered, though, a question on my mind. Cobb?
Yeah?
Why don't you fly with us? The other flight instructors go up with their cadets. I braced myself for anger or reprimand. Cobb just patted his leg.
Old wounds, Spin. Old wounds.
He'd been shot down soon after the Battle of Alta. His leg had clipped the side of the canopy as he'd ejected. You don't need your leg to fly.
Some wounds, he said softly, aren't as obvious as a twisted leg. You found it hard to get into the cockpit today, after watching your friends die? Try doing it after you shoot down one of your own.
I felt a sudden and striking coldness wash through me, like I'd ejected at high altitude. Was he saying he was the one who had shot down my father? Cobb looked up at me.
Who else do you think they'd order to bring him down, kid? I was his wingmate. I followed him when he ran.
He didn't run.
I was there. He ran, Spencer.
My father was not a coward. I met Cobb's gaze, and for the second time that day, he looked away. What really happened up there, Cobb? I narrowed my eyes at him. Why do they think they can tell I'll do the same just by monitoring my brain? What aren't you telling me? Though I'd never accepted the official story, part of me had always assumed that some kind of mistake had caused my father's reputation. That in the confusion, people had assumed he'd turned coward when he hadn't. But I now had the chance to talk to someone who was there. Someone who had pulled the trigger. What happened? I asked, stepping forward. I'd meant to say it forcefully, defiantly, but it came out as a whispered plea. Can you tell me? What you saw?
You've read the official report, Cobb said, still not meeting my eyes. The Krell were coming in a huge wave, carrying a lifebuster. It was a larger force than we'd ever faced before, and their positioning strongly indicated they'd found Alta Base. We fought off one attack, but they regrouped. As they were preparing to come at us again, your father panicked. He screamed that the enemy force was too big, that we were all going to die.
Who did he say it to? The entire flight? Cobb paused.
Yes. All four of us who were left, anyway. Well, he screamed and screamed. Then he broke off and began flying away. You have to understand how dangerous that was for us. We were literally fighting for the survival of our species. If other ships started fleeing, it would have been chaos. We couldn't afford to-
You followed him, I interrupted. He took off and flew away and you followed. Then you shot him down?
The order came almost immediately from our flight leader. Shoot him down, to make an example and prevent anyone else from fleeing. I was right on his tail, and he wouldn't respond to our pleas. So I hit my IMP and brought down his shield. Then I shot. I'm a soldier. I obey orders.
The pain in his voice was so real, so personal. It almost made me feel ashamed for pushing him. For the first time, my resolve shook. Could it be true? You swear to me, I asked. That's exactly how it happened. Cobb finally met my eyes. He held them this time and didn't look away, but he also didn't answer my question. I saw him harden as he set his jaw. And in that moment, I knew that his non-answer was an answer. He'd given me the official story, and it was a lie.
It's past time for you to be going, Cadet, Cobb said. If you want a copy of the official record, I can get you one.
But it's a lie, isn't it? I looked to him again, and he gave the faintest, almost imperceptible nod. My entire world lit up. I should have been angry. I should have been furious at Cobb for pulling the trigger. Instead, I was elated. My father hadn't run. My father wasn't a coward. But why? I asked. What's to be gained by pretending one of your pilots fled?
Go, Cobb said, pointing. That's an order, Cadet.
This is why Ironsides doesn't want me in the DDF, I realized. She knows I'll ask questions, because... Scud. She was your flight leader, wasn't she?
The one who gave the order to shoot my father down.
The name was redacted in the reports, but she's the only one who fits.
I looked back at Cobb, and his face was growing red with anger. Or maybe embarrassment. He'd just given me a secret, an important one, and... Well, he looked like he was having second thoughts. I wasn't going to get any more out of him right now. I grabbed my pack and hurried out. My heart was broken for the friends I'd lost, and now I'd have to deal with the fact that my instructor was also my father's killer. But for now, well, I felt like a soldier planting her flag at the top of a hard-fought hill. All these years I'd dreamed and studied and trusted that my father had actually been a hero. And I'd been right. Chapter 22.
What reason, Rig asked as we worked together, could the DDF possibly have to pretend your father was a coward?
I can think of dozens of scenarios, I said, lying underneath M-Bot beside him. 5 days had passed since the event, since we'd lost Bim and Morningtide. Working with Rig off hours, repairing the ship, had been a welcome solace from my own thoughts. Even if it was taxing to get up early like I had today, work on the ship, then go to class and endure Cobb's instructions all day. Today, we were unhooking wires from M-Bot's belly and replacing them with new ones. Some of the old ones seemed good, but Rig figured we should replace them all just in case, and I wasn't going to argue with his expertise. I plugged in another wire and threaded it according to the instructions Rig had drawn out earlier. My light line glowed from within the ship, wound through the innards to give us light, itself like a glowing wire. There are literally hundreds of reasons the DDF would lie about my father, I said as I worked. Maybe my father was in conflict with Ironsides about leadership, and she decided to make him have an accident. In the middle of the most important battle the DDF had ever flown? Rig said. That's fanciful, even for you, Spin.
Fanciful? I demanded. Me?
I'm a realist, Rig.
Realist? Like all the times you made me go pretend to slay star dragons with you as kids.
That was battle training. He grunted as he worked on a particularly stubborn wire, and Doomslug helpfully imitated him. She sat on the stone ground near my head. M-Bot was running diagnostics, whatever that meant. It mostly involved him saying things like, hmm, or carry the one, to give indication that the process is continuing, as humans quickly grow bored without auditory stimulation.
Are you sure you aren't misinterpreting Cobb? Rig said from beside me. You're sure? He nodded.
I am. The official story is a lie, Rig. I've got proof.
More like a vague possible confirmation.
I can push Cobb until he spills the entire truth.
Good luck with that. Besides, even if he did talk, the higher powers of the DDF aren't going to admit to lying. You stir up too much trouble, and all you'll do is get yourself and Cobb removed from your positions.
I will clear my father's name, Rig.
I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm just pointing out that your original plan, learning to fly, is still the best way to do that. First, become a great, famous pilot. Improve your family's reputation and become someone who can't be ignored. Then, use your influence to clear your father's name.
We'll see. Rig twisted, using the little space we had between M-Bot and the ground, and pulled over his notebook to make some notations.
These are his grav caps, he said, tapping his pencil at a mechanism. But I don't recognize the design. And he has them in an odd location. This black box over here, which is the only part I don't recognize, must be what houses his artificial intelligence. I don't dare try to break that apart, although it's obviously malfunctioning.
How do you know?
Can you imagine anyone intentionally creating him to act like he does?
A valid point.
What I'm most interested in, Rig said, is his joints, his seals, and his atmospheric scoop.
It's hard to explain, but they all feel tighter, more finely constructed than what we're using.
It's only by a small increase.